Okay, I will take that as a staunch no. So we are open for questions tonight. Again, I would prefer if the first few questions are amateur radio related, but we accept any science or technology questions. If you are so inclined, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign, and we will put you on the list for tonight.
W2BC, ham radio related.
Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down tonight? Okay, I'm not quite sure if that's Alex. A very noisy signal. If there's any way you can kind of clean it up a little bit, I'd appreciate it. I guess not. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list before we start this segment? Okay, very well. So I guess, Rich, you're the only one on the list, so you're first. What's your question tonight, Rich?
Yeah, Roy, I know we've been over this stuff before, but I still don't understand it. What's the difference between an antenna that's capacitive and an antenna that's inductive, and why do we care? Short and simple, that's the question.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. Well, I don't exactly know the best way to kind of answer that. Antennas are not supposed to be capacitive or inductive. An antenna at resonance, by definition, has no reactance. It has neither inductive reactance nor capacitive reactance. When you neutralize all of the reactants, you are left with pure resistance. And a resonant antenna should be a pure resistant device. The efficiency of that device is based upon the fraction of the resistance that is radiation resistance, and the fraction that is ohmic energy loss, heat dissipation. The greater the resistance in radiation, the more percentage of the energy is transferred into radio waves. The less radiation resistance, the more the energy is transferred into heat waste.
But isn't it on a Smith chart? Can't you see there's a line, horizontal line, that I thought above it is inductive resistance and below it is capacitive or inductance, capacitive inductance? I'm not quite sure of the terminology. Does an antenna with a high SWR, will it show more inductive reactance than capacitive reactance?
Okay, there's a whole bunch of terms here. You can have an SWR that's perfect because SWR simply means its impedance. So an SWR just means that it has 50 ohms of impedance. It could be 50 ohms of inductive impedance, of capacitive impedance, or pure resistive impedance. It's the pure resistive impedance that designates that 50 ohms to be a resonance. So you can have a completely non-resonant antenna that just happens to have a 50 ohm impedance, and it's not going to work a heck of a lot well. So the important thing is to get yourself on the Smith chart on that straight line, because that straight line has zero inductive reactance and zero capacitive reactance. It is a purely resistive line, and that, by definition, is the resonance of the radiator. Once you got a resonant radiator with a real resistance with no reactance, Then you have to concern yourself to match the impedance with the rest of your system so that you can have an efficient transfer of power, because that antenna could be wonderfully resonant but have an impedance of 2,000 ohms at the antenna point, like an NFED half-wave. But if you have an impedance mismatch, instead of getting the energy to the antenna, you'll get a lot of reflection before it goes into it, and it'll go up and down the transmission line. So we're sort of talking about two completely different things. One is resonance, which is non-reactance. The other is a one-to-one standing wave ratio in which the load impedance is 50 ohms.
Okay, so if your antenna is too capacitive, what do?
You place an inductor in it. That's kind of, if you've ever seen whip antennas, in order to make out the fact that making an antenna too short, you're trying to design, say, a mobile antenna that is one quarter wave, but it would be too long, so you make it shorter. As you make a quarter wave shorter, it builds up a capacitive reactance that you don't want. In order to get rid of the capacitive reactance, you put something like a loading coil at the base, and that introduces inductive capacitance. Add the capacitive reactance to the inductive reactance, and at a certain point, they zero out together. And you're completely left with pure resistance of your shortened quarter wave with a loaded coil.
So inductors or loading coils, they have nothing to do with SWR, is that true?
They may incidentally affect the SWR, but the primary reason for them existing is to remove the capacitive reactance caused by a mechanically too short non-resonant antenna. First you resonate, then you match. So that's why you don't have to match in the antenna. You could match with a ballon past the antenna, but you do have to match it. If you don't, you'll get reflections back on the transmission line, because it's like optical light. Different impedances are like different refractive indexes. So if you look at a pane of glass, you see the pane of glass. The reason why you see it, even though it's transparent, is because its refractive index is different. So light that hits it, some percentage will reflect back, and you see the reflection, and you've kind of learned about glass, and you see the glass. So if you have a mismatch between your antenna feed and your antenna, that will cause some of the energy to be reflected back to the transmission line, which you don't want. You want it all transferred to the antenna and ready to radiate on a resonant antenna.
Can a resonant antenna be too capacitive?
No. By definition, a resonant antenna is resistant. It is not reactant.
Okay, I think I got it now. So when we're building antennas, we've got to look out for two things. Where on that Smith chart, on that line, does the reactants land? And then we deal with SWR and matching the impedance.
Yes, exactly. Like I mentioned with a half-wave NFED. A half-wave NFED is a resonant antenna, but because of the position of the antenna feed, the impedance, which is purely resistant because it's resonant, is very high. It's 2,000-3,000 ohms. You can't really effectively transfer energy from a system that's designed to transfer it to 50 ohms into a load that's 2,000 ohms. That's where you put the 49-to-1 ballon in between, so you bring down the impedance to something much closer to the one that's on the resonant antenna, and you get the antenna to work right.
Okay. I think I have the relationships now worked out a little better. So pretty sure I got it this time. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. Anyone with any other comments or questions related to Rich's subject, please feel free, hit that push to talk.
Okay, thank you. This is KD2WIC. I'm calling from Oceanside. My name is Henry. How are you?
Vice versa.
Okay, unfortunately, Chris, you doubled with someone else. That someone else, I couldn't quite make out who you might be, but welcome to the Limark Technical Net. Because I recognize Chris, I'll ask Chris what comment he made.
Yeah, the comment was, you know, would it be fair to say that if you're dealing with an antenna that's too capacitive, for example, adding inductance would be the antidote, and if you're dealing with an antenna that's too inductive, adding capacitance would be the antidote.
Yes, that's a kind of a simple way of saying it that makes sense, and that's very useful. The problem is unfortunately always in the details, because just as you can get a shortened quarter wave whip into resonance by applying a loading coil, usually at the base because it's mechanically much sturdier, although it would be a more efficient loading coil if it was somewhere between the middle towards the top, but then it would weigh it down. Another way of introducing actually inductance and tuning an antenna would be to have a capacitive hat, which strike a lot of people as counterintuitive, because it sounds like you're adding a capacitor because the thing is called a capacitive hat. Yet the capacitive hat will effectively electronically lengthen a shortened quarter wave. And in addition, it's a little bit better and more efficient than putting a loading coil, because putting a loading coil will lead to a slightly lower radiation resistance and a slightly lower efficiency of the antenna, whereas if you place a capacitive hat, although it's a mechanical horror to keep that stabilized on something like a car or something, because you'll never see that, it actually keeps a decent radiation resistance and is a much more efficient way of electronically lengthening a shortened antenna.
Okay, thanks. Back to net control.
Yes, John. Yes, John, did you hear me? You can say your piece.
Yeah, sorry, there seems to be some weird packets coming through or something. After you guys talk, there's occasionally a break and then some just odd noise. Anyway, can you hear me okay? Hope you got me.
Yes, I can hear you. There's a little background noise going on, but I can understand you.
Okay, I've read these words, but I always think when these questions come up, it's just explained in an elegant way. And again, sorry to be a broken record and to always go back to the archives, but I turned this bit into text for a reason, because for me it worked really well, and I'll read it real quick. For an antenna or an antenna system to work, first it must resonate, then it can radiate. Energy launched into the antenna bounces back and forth something like 30 times. With the correct length, those bounces are in co-phase, which makes the antenna look like a resistor. Make the antenna a little too long and the bounces will become lagging in phase and it will look more inductive. Make the antenna resonating in phase, and it will look more capacitive. Resonating means all the bounces are in phase. So I just love those words. It's simple and elegant. KC2GS, words from Dick Nadel.
Yes, I agree, John. I remember you reading it one time before, too. The problem is that that's a beautiful description and definition and explanation for resonance. And as I agreed then, and I agree now with Dick, first thing you do is resonate it. Also, an aspect that Rich brought up was, what about the SWR? You know, because there are people out there, unfortunately, whose simplification of what's going on is that if you get back a 1-to-1 SWR, everything is peachy keen. But, you know, that's not what resonance is about. SWR has more to do with the efficiencies of energy transfer. So that having a 1-to-1 SWR means that you're pushing your energy across the antenna feed into the radiator. The radiator may or may not be actually resonant, but it might have just by happenstance a nominal 50 ohms of impedance. It could be 50 ohms of capacitive impedance or inductive impedance. But, you know, so the energy transfer would be nice, but you wouldn't have the resonance that you just so lovely described. And that's just what I was adding to the mix.
Yeah, I was just hopeful that those words would be helpful with the discussion about the inductive and capacitive parts of this discussion here. So, obviously, you know, as we all know, you can have a great SWR into a resistor, but then there is no bouncing, there is no in phase, all the energy just absorbed and turned into heat with none of what I just described. But anyway, yeah, I just like those words, so they work well. And I try to explain these things to other people, so I hope some people find them useful. That's all. EC2GS, your wealth of knowledge, as always. I just like to add that in there. 73 for now. I'll be listening. EC2SHO.
VDH.
Well, John. Yes, John.
Maybe I misunderstood you, but. I just wanted to mention a 50 ohms of reactance, 50 ohm capacitive reactance, or 50 ohms inductive reactance will not give a 1-to-1 SWR. I might have misunderstood you. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, wouldn't it give you that impedance? Just an SWR is just the simplified version is just any kind of complex impedance, be it resistive, reactive, inductive, or capacitive.
Now, SWR is 1 plus the magnitude of the reflection coefficient divided by 1 minus the magnitude of the reflection coefficient. If the impedance is 50 ohms pure inductive or 50 ohms pure capacitive, the reflection coefficient is not zero. The reflection coefficient is 1 at 90 degrees or 1 at minus 90 degrees, and that gives an infinite SWR.
Okay, but what happens if you plug it into a VNA? And just take the numbers. Wouldn't you get a kind of spurious response that it was 1-to-1?
It would not give you 1-to-1 SWR. It would a 50 ohms inductive reactance will give you a reflection coefficient that is like 1 at 90 degrees. It gives you a unity reflection coefficient. You get total reflection. So, and if you form the SWR, which is 1 plus the magnitude of the reflection coefficient over 1 minus the magnitude of the reflection coefficient, you get 1 plus 1 over 1 minus 1, which is infinity. You get an extremely high SWR. So you have to really look at the reflection coefficient, which is complex, before you form the SWR. Go ahead.
Is it Bill?
Yes?
Divide by zero is not infinity. It's a nonsense.
My point is, though, that inductive reactants, pure inductive reactants or pure capacitive reactants of 50 ohms, that puts you on the rim of the Smith chart. Let's say we're working in a 50-ohm system. 50 ohms pure inductive reactants, when you normalize that, that's 1, that's J1, 1 at 90 degrees, and that's on the rim of the Smith chart. It's 1 plus, it's a 0 plus J1. And you're opening your compass up to the full radius of the Smith chart. When you go on the SWR, you're going to have an extremely high, when you go on the radially scaled parameters, you're going to have an extremely high SWR.
Okay, I mean, the problem, unfortunately, is that there's practically an infinite number of ways to measure and figure out SWRs. I mean, in some cases, SWRs are calculated from the percentage of reflected energy, which assumes that the transmission line doesn't attenuate much. I was just thinking that some cheap VNAs that just read out impedances compared to absolute impedances without phase information will erroneously see 50 ohms of capacitive or inductive capacitance and just report 50 ohms, and it would kind of show up as a one-to-one on a VNA cheap program kind of spitting it out. But I don't know. I haven't really investigated that aspect. I think there are probably ways of fooling a VNA, especially if you don't really obtain phase information and such, just absolute impedances.
Well, that's why we have the V in VNA rather than an SNA. The VNA means vector network analyzer. It's treating measurements as complex numbers. A scalar network analyzer would just say 50 ohms, but a vector network analyzer treats it as 0 plus J50. So in other words, it's treating it as a phasor quantity, a vector quantity. And as I said, that's going to give you a pure inductive reactance or pure capacitive reactance with no resistance, puts you on the rim of the Smith chart. And if you open your compass up to the rim of the chart and then go down to the SWR radially scale parameters, you'll see you're at the extremely high, I won't say infinity, extremely high SWR. Go ahead.
No, I agree with you that using all the information from a vector network analyzer, you wouldn't be confused. But I think there are ways to use plots that kind of throw out, unfortunately, all that information and can just spit out an absolute impedance curve, and you can draw the wrong conclusion based upon that.
Yes, yeah, some of those cheap MFA, those antenna analyzers, there are ones that are scalar that don't give you the reactive portion or just give you the magnitude. And, yeah, that can get very confusing. They will confuse the heck out of you.
Yeah, and like I said before, I think there are ways to screw up a VNA and not have it indicate the vector information and the phase information, so it gives you a simplified wrong picture. But, you know, I mean, that's what I was kind of alluding to. I wasn't alluding to the fact that under all circumstances you would get a one-to-one SWR if you had that type of absurd reactance on your antenna, but that some some meters would kind of give you a false response of a 1-to-1. Okay, UAC2GS, any other comments on this subject? Or if not, does anyone have any other questions or subjects?
AD2DU.
Yes, Alex.
So I looked at the NOAA space weather overview. And because the ham radio people seem to pay a lot of attention to space weather. It lists solar X-ray flux, solar proton flux, and geomagnetic activity with a little chart. What do I care about there? And in what, like, it practically, how is that actionable for me? AD2DU.
Well, you want high X-ray. The sunspots are going to throw a splash of high energy particles, and that will kind of energize the ionosphere. Geomagnetism kind of just produces, as far as I'm aware, general background noise. So magnetic storms will disrupt transmissions. High outputs will energize higher layers of the ionosphere and improve propagation in the 2010 6 meters most of the time and screw up 80 and 160.
Got it. So are any of them all bad or all good, or do they just affect different bands in different ways?
Yeah, like the saying goes, it's complicated. So, yeah, there's nothing 100% good. It gives with one hand and it takes with the other. It's just, you know, when you're talking about summer months, the ionosphere tends to get a little bit more active during the sunspot. The maximum, the ionosphere is more energized, so you get better propagation in 20 meters and 10 meters and 6 meters. But the downside is when those things are happening, they're also wreaking havoc with the D layer of 80 and 160 and producing a lot of background noise. The background noise on the lower bands go up during the summer months and during the sunspot maximums. So there's nothing that's good for everyone. You know, it's like life, unfortunately.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, on the NOAA site, I like the K index. It says planetary K index. Creep to, you know, it's showing that, you know, the ionosphere is being affected by the you might have a solar flare and you see a couple of days later, or sometimes 24 hours later, you'll see the numbers start creeping up, or and sometimes it stays like that. It goes up and down for about 4 or 5 days after that, but if you start to see numbers like 4, you could say, well, it's getting pretty active. Or even 3, and then you click on another thing where you get the model of the northern, northern part of the Earth, and you could actually see how active the auroras are, from the sun. But the K index, that gives you not a vertical, but more of a horizontal idea of what's going up in the atmosphere. It's particles traveling back and forth from the South Pole to the North Pole. So I've noticed that if that thing's getting pretty high, chances of like 20 meters being open is really good, or you know, some one of the bands. Well, like you said, it's hit and miss, but it shows it's more active. If you have a good K index, and they update this thing every like 3 hours or so, it'll be changing. But I save it as a favorite. You know, I always look at the K index. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, the K index is very useful. It measures a whole bunch of different things. I think even moisture and the amount of thunderstorms affect the K index. So it's a reasonably good one. Unfortunately, there's no great magic number that's going to tell you how good a band is. Because, I mean, you look at all these indicators, and 10 meters should be decent. And yet, you know, I do my 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock on 28.380, by the way. And I talk to a couple people locally. I haven't really talked to anyone outside of the metropolitan area in at least a month. And yet I look at the solar indicators, and they say propagation should be decent. So unfortunately, the F1, F2 layer doesn't read the same reports I do.
How far out?
Let me see if I have it.
Does the K index forecast essentially again? What, like 0 to 3 days or 5 days? 82 to give.
Okay. Do you see the K index on the NOAA site? Those green bars keep changing from hour to hour. You know. The highest one was a few hours ago. I see a 3 and then 2.5, which is actually okay. By the way, the K index is really good if you're going up north and you want to walk. You're looking for the aurora borealis. You know, if you get to this tier 5 or something like that, even now, which is normally it's a bad time. The winter time is better up north, but 5 or 6, even during this time of year, you'll get to see the aurora borealis to some extent, let's say if you're up in Alaska. But, I guess back to you, Roy.
Yeah, thank you, C2GS. I think Alex sort of sees it as a predictive quantity from the sun. The K index is more of a planetary index, so it's relatively real time to the Earth. So it doesn't really predict things, say, in 3 days as indicators of the actual sunspot activity itself, because there's a finite amount of time it takes for all those energized particles to travel from the sun to the surface and to the ionosphere and other aspects of the Earth. So K index is close to real time.
Looking for a couple of days out, then you got to go with the sunspot numbers, you know, 140, 145, you know, you start to see 150, you know, it's going to be good in a couple of days. That's the other one I use. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, because in that case, you're dealing with the time difference for the particles to make it through space, as opposed to K-index is just an indicator of electrostatic and geoelectric energies and thunderstorms and all kinds of fun stuff in relatively real time here on the Earth.
Okay, yeah. You know, when they were doing those HOP experiments up in Alaska, it actually affected the K index a little bit. So they were blasting away at the ionosphere. But they you know, it actually changed it somewhat, you know. But, you know, if you got plenty of plenty of protons or, you know, bouncing around in the atmosphere, going back and forth from the different poles. You know, it's going to help. You know, it shows that the ionosphere is out. And, you know, if you look at what's happening now, chances are it's going to be like that for the next day or so. You want 3 or 4 days out, then you're going to get involved with the sunspots, you know, whether or not you have a corona mass ejection coming off the sun, you know, is it heading toward Earth? It could be heading somewhere, but if it's heading toward Earth, it could be a problem. So, by the way, Jim, the ARRL, had a good email that he sent out from the ARRL talking about the 1940 where the corona mass ejection. There was two of them, one after the other, and it created like 800 volts in the wiring system of telegraph systems back then. I don't know if you saw that one. I thought that was pretty good. I saved that. That was a very good, it was part of a email that he had sent out. Very well done. Back to you, Roy.
Paul, do you mean the 1840 incident? Because that was a historic telegraph poles kind of blew up because of all the energy released.
Oh, okay. There was one in 1940. You know, we weren't into the war yet, but we were getting there. Talking about the 1940.
Oh, okay. I wasn't familiar with the 1941. I think the 1840, I think they called that the Covington incident or something, and it's just because the only thing that we had that would be affected by such things were the telegraph industry. All those wires running high in the sky would just you know, started to melt and go on fire because of all the induced energy it absorbed.
Oh, okay. Let me just figure out which one this was. Here it is. No, that's not that. I'll find it in a second. Back to you, Rob.
I mean, you can imagine what a disaster that would be to all of our satellites, especially because I think a lot of them need to be operational, not to bang into each other. One of these days, you know, more and more of these guys are putting, you know, thousands of satellites up there. It's going to be like a billiard ball act. You know, one's going to bounce into 3, bounce into 10, bounce into 12. And the trouble is there are no pockets up there, so... You know, I don't exactly know what we're going to do with all these damn satellites. I think we're putting a few too many up there, in my humble opinion.
I concur. Yeah, this was titled The Great Solar Storm of March 1940. Actually, officially it was March 24th. But, you know, people were paying attention to the war and stuff. And the ones that really noticed this were the people that were involved with telegraphs. Back then, that was a concern because you didn't have power lines going all over the country. If the same thing hit this time, you know, you'd have probably problems with the power grid. But, yeah, this is a... Just trying to see. Well, I don't know. It was sent by Jim, K2KFB. He's a section manager for New York City and Long Island. But it's very well done. I saved it. I don't know. Maybe I'll send it over to you, Roy. It would be a good thing to maybe put on your website. Interesting story. Back to you.
WB2BXO here. Yeah, I saw that in Tim Cook's email, and that's probably where the section manager got it from. They said that was comparable to the Carrington event. So there were two different ones, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, the Carrington event, it took place 1859. I think it was solar cycle 10. But that's odd that it kind of did the same sort of thing. You think that the actual radios would, the front end of radios would burn out or something in addition to just telegraph poles. I mean, it made sense back in 1859 because the only electrical stuff was the telegraph poles for the most part. So I'll have to read it. I get his email. I didn't get around to reading it this week, so I'll pull it out of my my files and brush it up and read up on it again. I don't think it quite made the same impact that the Carrington effect did back in the 1800s, but who knows? I wasn't around for either of those.
Yeah, well, remember the old radios were a lot more...
You can read it later, and if you like it, you can put it on your website. Very well done.
Go ahead.
They said if it happened today, you'd have big problems probably with the grid.
Well, yeah, I would imagine it would wreak havoc on just about anything and everything. Unfortunately, you doubled with Frank. I assume people heard you and didn't hear Frank. So, Frank, if you'd like to repeat yourself.
Yeah, I would imagine that the reason the March 1940 event didn't have a huge impact on radios was that the receivers at the time were big tube receivers, which were, if I remember correctly, the tube stuff, especially the older tube stuff, is a lot less susceptible to overload than the radios, or the radio receivers we use today. Yeah, go ahead.
PDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I think what really caused the major problems is that during one of these coronal mass ejections, you get very slight variations in the Earth's magnetic field, and that's what induced those very high voltages into the telegraph lines, where they say some cases that they were arcing at the ends of the telegraph lines, or they saw arcing on the poles. And the same thing with the grid, a very high geomagnetic activity which causes the slightly shifting of the Earth's magnetic field, causing induced voltages into the grid, very high induced voltages into the grid. And that's, I think, what really causes the problem. Okay?
Oh, okay. I didn't hear that one. It wouldn't come to mind. I kind of always think of the Earth's magnetic field, you know, it's really big, but it is not terribly strong in any one place. So fluctuations locally, I don't know if they'd really manifest and induce that much current, but it's an interesting idea. Well, any other comments or questions, hit that push-to-talk button. We still got a little time.
Okay, this is one of the things that doubled with Greg Henry
a while back. I think it was called, but his name was Henry. I don't know if he's still listening. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I think you doubled with Henry again. So if that was you, Henry, then please tell me what you wanted to say, because every time you tell me, you're doubling with someone else, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you very much. I got your opinion about different things, non-antennas, about my high-frequency a mobile station. I just put my radio in my car, the Jesu NHF. I installed it, but I got an issue because according with the manual, I put, you know, I had before long time ago in the same station, but different car, and I put my my radio connect to the positive, to the negative, from to the battery. So that's why usually everybody does. But I got an issue with the car, and then when I connect those like that, the lights comes up with the car. So the engine light comes up and everything. So my friend, he told me, yes, connect from the radio the red wire to the battery and connect the negative to any screw for the ground. I mean, maybe for the chassis. I connect that way and it's working fine for right now, but I want to make sure if that's the right way to connect. That's my question. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I don't really have a lot of experience with cars, so I'll ask people listening in. Usually the general advice is to connect it directly to the battery poles. I'm a little confused. Why doing that unless there was a lot of RF leak into that area, why it would affect any other system? But people who have modern day cars, feel free to explain it to Henry and to me. We're not really eliciting much in the way of response. Give a second try. Anyone has a good explanation of why connecting it to ground instead of the positive of the negative pole, he had less problems with his radio? And should he leave it just connected to ground, or is there safer things to do? Doesn't seem to be a lot of car fans out there, afraid. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you know, the old adage is, if it works, I guess it's okay. But I would still be curious and interested to know why the initial connection caused that effect. Problem is that modern-day cars aren't like the good old ones that I'm used to. You know, it's kind of like legacy radios and SDRs. They're all filled with computers, and some manufacturers detest people putting transmitting radios into their cars. If you call up the dealership, if you call up the manufacturer, a lot of times they'll tell you don't do that, rather than provide you with some good advice of how to do it safely. So, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get any suggestions from the audience tonight. Again, I'll just throw it out one last time. Someone out there has expertise in installing radios into cars and in the modern car technology these days, and knows the best way and the worst way and wants to share it, please do.
WS2M, what was the problem? Something about the lights coming on? Was that all? You know, was it only when he transmitted, or what was the problem?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. He said that he connected the power supplies directly to the battery and the lights went on. So I assume that the lights went on. But let's find out. When your lights went on, was that immediately when you turned the radio on, or was that only when you transmitted?
No, when I transmitted, just 2 seconds, 1 second, the light comes out after one second after that I transmit, and the acceleration and go, and the RP go a little bit up, so that's why, you know, probably the battery need more power. That's why they tell you to the battery, they'll give me more power. So I'm really surprised anyway, but it's a good answer about you. Maybe I can contact with the dealer, the dealer, and I call them. But I try to speak with anybody, ham radio operators. They got more experience about it. But I didn't get it because sometimes some people they don't have a mobile station at that time, so I didn't have that answer. So anyway, if you know, that's the question. Okay, this is KD2 Whiskey India Charlie. Go ahead.
Okay, let's get a couple of little bits of information. Maybe that'll help people out. What frequency were you usually transmitting on, and how much power were you putting out? That it overpowered your lead acid battery's power source.
Well, I put 100 watts. That's it. 100 watts. That usually do. But I have the Toyota 4Runner 2018, and then before when I used that kind of equipment, the same equipment, I got a Toyota in 1980. So they had no computer and you know everything analog. So that are the things. I don't know. Maybe the car. Maybe. But I don't want to mix with the car. That's what the things. But for now it's working okay. So I transmit now about 1 week and a half, and nothing happened. But I want to make sure everything okay like that. But the thing, thank you. Over.
Okay, very good. See what the dealer has to say. I'm still a little confused because if it was a case of you pulling too much power. Theoretically, I would imagine that you're still pulling too much power, but perhaps the ground is not a perfect source of the battery, and so you're getting a slight voltage decrease, and the total output that your radio's working with is just less amps. So maybe it's kind of acting as a kind of a very low resistance in the power supply source, and it's giving you some current limiting and not letting you kind of draw too much from the battery. But you know, I mean, you could ask the dealership. I wish I could kind of give you a better information here, but most of the people here I think are doing UHF EHF at something like 20 watts or so. So you're 100 watts is probably a little bit more than the average listener is using in his car.
Yeah, QSL. So I spoke with Oscar, but I forgot his call sign. He wrote it mobile too, but he has put 500 watts for the amplifier. But it's crazy right now. But usually you can use 100 watts. According with the equipment, that's okay. But 20, maybe 20 watts, nobody hear you. So that's the things. But thank you anyway. That's my question, and probably I get the answer soon with that dealer. But thank you anyways again. Back to you. This is KD2, the Whiskey India Charlie.
Okay, Henry, again, sorry we couldn't give you a nice, simple answer for it. And if you do find out a good answer for it, please come back and tell us so that we can learn from your experience as well. So thank you very much for participating, Henry. This continues to be AC2GS with the Linemark Technical Med. If anyone else has any comments or questions or topics for discussion, please hit that push-to-talk button.
This is KB2FIH with a question.
Yes, FIH.
IKT with comments about mobile installations.
Okay, FIH, we'll put you on hold for a little bit because the gentleman wants to answer, hopefully, Henry's question. So please, you have the repeater.
Thank you, Brian. This is George WB2. The kilowatt Tango. I have a 50-watt level radio on VHF, UHF. It's a tri-band radio installed in my car, which is a 2013 Ford C-Max.
the nature of the vehicle, the type of vehicle, and so on probably makes a difference. And I haven't heard anybody talking about what kind of car it is. Or is it a hybrid car? Is it an electric car? Is it a traditional internal combustion engine? Is it a diesel? That all is going to make a difference. But to start with, Ford has published a book probably around 2016, and it's online. You can download it. It's called the Mobile Radio Installation Guidelines. And it tells you a lot of stuff about what you need to do to install the radio so it won't screw up the car and the radio will work properly. I strongly suggest looking for that handbook and following its advice. Let's start from there, Roy.
Okay, Henry mentioned that he had a Toyota. I assumed it was just your basic gas model. But Henry, if you're still out there, is your Toyota a regular gas engine or is it somewhat esoteric?
Yes, my Toyota is regular engine V6. It's no electrical. It's no electrical. It's regular car. That's the thing. But probably the car, he doesn't like it anyway because I don't hear. I went to on Facebook and joined with the my equipment, Jesu A91 equipment. And I asked the same question to the people, but nobody answered. So, you know, online you can join and you can make any question and somebody can be able to help. You know, you can get a lot of help over there too, but nobody answered that question. But anyway, thank you. But this is a regular car. It's not electrical. So I got the manual too, and I read the manual that the dealer said you can connect in the electrical car. The electrical car, that happens with those cars. If you have electrical, like Tesla or something like that, you can put your radio in the car. But this is different. This is a different car. But for now, the car is working good. It's no problem. They don't do anymore. So let's see what happens. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Henry. Any comments out there?
Okay, I'll point out a couple of things. Irregardless of the type of vehicle, this particular little book, it's a PDF file, and it's sort of like an installation guide. It's called the Mobile Radio Guide. It has some advice, one of which is maintain a distance as great as possible between your mobile radio power leads and the vehicle's electronic modules and wiring. Don't run your radio power leads in parallel with the vehicle wiring over long distances, which I would think mean over a couple of feet. Keep the radio wiring separate from the car's wiring. Make sure your antenna, when you're transmitting, has a good SWR. That could wreak havoc on things. Make sure the SWR is good, and this particular paper says make sure it's less than 2:1. Worst case, make sure that the cable is treated in the same way as power and control cables. Don't run it next to wiring in the vehicle. And if you do have to run it near vehicle running wiring, wire it at right angles. And the book, this little guide notes that shielding between sets of wires may be helpful. And if possible, for your power wiring from the battery to your radio, probably ought to be in some kind of an electrical conduit, if that's at all possible, just for the shielding. Let's see, should interaction come, their suggestion is to make sure your antenna is in good shape, that the SWR is good, and route your cabling properly. And then it suggests the ARRL book called RFI, How to Find It and Fix It. And that's a publication by ARRL. It's called the RFI book. I do have a copy of it, and it's pretty good. And another unexpected source is the Champion Spark Plug Company. They have a book called Giving Two-Way Radio Its Voice, and that might prove useful as well. You might want to look that one up.